Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, why did Christ hide his identity from the first disciples to see him after his resurrection? And how this event on the road to Emmaus is depicted in art? But first, Pope Benedict welcomes some 3,000 members of the worldwide Franciscan family at the papal summer residence at Castel Gandolfo. As the Franciscan community celebrates 800 years of the founding of their order, we take a look at one of the more famous Franciscan saints from right here in Italy, where it all began. Millions of Catholics around the world are devoted to him, and thousands can thank him for providing dignified and professional health care when they had nowhere else to turn. Padre Pio of Pietralcina died on September 23, 1968, but his legacy looks likely to endure for decades to come. This humble Capuchin priest, who many will remember for bearing the stigmata, the visible signs of Christ's passion, spent most of his life in the southeastern Italian town of San Giovanni Rotondo. Made a saint by Pope John Paul II in 2002, Padre Pio helped build the Home for Relief from Suffering, a large hospital that treats patients from all over Italy and abroad for a wide variety of illnesses. Well, I sat down with Father Gianluigi Pasquale, a Franciscan Capuchin friar of Padre Pio's own order, and author of the book Secrets of a Soul, Padre Pio's Letters to His Spiritual Directors. Father Pasquale told me that he had never taken much of an interest in Padre Pio until he was asked by his superior to prepare a series of conferences on the Capuchin friar. Father Pasquale was living in Germany at the time, and his task was to prepare German pilgrims who were coming to Italy for the beatification celebrations for Padre Pio. He confided to me that he was really taken aback by his superior's order, but that it soon became a very personal passion as he learned more and more about this simple priest from Pietralcina.
I answered to the superior, Paolo Stervite, I don't know nothing about Padre Pio, because I never read nothing about him. And he told me, you have to start. And I asked, why? Because even though you are not keen on Padre Pio, you are an Italian man, and so you have the facilities and the abilities to read his writings. So I started to read the letters, the famous epistolario, the collection of his letters, and I prepared two sermons in German. And I give these two sermons in Liebfrauen, which is a very famous Catholic church in Frankfurt, from the Capuchins there. It's a sanctuary, a shrine, actually. And there was in the church a Jesuit father. I didn't know that there was a Jesuit father von München, the director of the review Geist und Leben, which means in English life and spirituality. And he recorded my conference in German, and he printed it.
He printed it?
Yes, oh, in this review. Hmm. And with a very big surprise, when I came back here in Rome, I was in Rome also to finish my doctorate at the Gregorian University, I saw the two articles. And this article were read in Milan from the director of the Paulinist Publishers House in Milan, Dr. Elio Guerriero, and he called me, asking me, would you like to write some books about Padre Pio, because you have discovered the mystic of Padre Pio. That was my first link. And since then, I felt myself to be very, very protected from Padre Pio, very, very protected. I got in touch with him in a very, very deep way.
You say Padre Pio died in 1968. How old were you then? Were you even born?
I was born just a year before, 1967.
1967. Yes. You didn't have any way to know him except through these letters.
Exactly, exactly. And through these letters, I discovered two very particular characteristics of Padre Pio, that he has a very deep spirituality, which is named mystic or mystagogic, which means to lead people with the possibilities to be in touch with God. That is the mystic. And I would say that Padre Pio could be in the future a doctor of the Church, but the main point, according to my point of view, which characterized Padre Pio, is that it was the first priest in the history of the Church, and also in the history of the world, who was stigmatized, who has the stigmata. Because the first one, everybody knows, that was St. Francis of Assisi, and Padre Pio as Capuchin is also a Franciscan, but St. Francis of Assisi was not a priest, was a deacon. Afterwards, there was a poor Claire Capuchins, Santa Veronica Giuliani, who had the stigmata in the 17th century, but the first Catholic priest, the first priest in absolute way of thinking, was Padre Pio. That means, according with my theological point of view, that to be priest stigmatized for Padre Pio belongs to be a part of Christ suffering on the Holy Cross, because a priest who has the stigmata is not like to be a normal man like Saint Francis, which is also holy, or Santa Veronica Giuliani.
You said that you think that he could become a doctor of the Church. Why do you say that?
Normally, the Catholic Church declares somebody doctor of the Church when they have a very own particular spirituality. And the Padre Pio, according to my theological point of view, has his own spirituality, which is to participate to the suffering, to the sufferings, to the penance with Jesus Christ on the Holy Cross. In fact, he received the stigmata, or the wound, on the 18 September 1918, just 4 days after the feast of Elevation of the Holy Cross, which is on our calendar on the 14th of September, and just 1 day before the 17th of September, when St. Francis received his first stigmata. And he was in the choir. After taking Holy Communion, he was alone, just in front of the Holy Cross, and he heard, as he has written in his letters, the voice of Jesus Christ saying, "Would you like to take part to my sufferings for the world, for the human being?" And he said, "Yes." And just in order to answer to your question, it happens during the First World War, 1918.
The First World War.
Exactly.
And he also lived through the Second World War. How did he live those two experiences?
In his letter, it is quite easy to find out, and it is quite understandable, that he participated with sufferings for the destruction. So many families were destroyed from this Second World War, and he participated with his silence. If we well remember what happened in the history of the Church for Padre Pio, in that years, the Congregation of the Holy Faith asked him to stay in silence starting from 1939 up to 1946. It is not interesting to realize that is just the time when the Second World War happened. So he, with his obedience to the Catholic Church, he participated, to be in silence, because he was asked not to hear more confession, not to celebrate the Holy Mass in public.
Because there were some doubts about his authenticity. Right?
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. With his obedience, deep obedience with the Catholic Church, he has always said, "I want to be obedient to the Catholic Church." The newspaper of the Holy See, L'Osservatore Romano, has written a very interesting article about these things, because Pope Benedict XVI has opened the old archive, the Archivio Segreto Vaticano.
The secret archives of the Vatican.
Yes, up to 1939. Mm-hmm. There is also a very good surprise and discovering that the Holy See has always had with Padre Pio a very protected behavior. The Holy See has always protected, as soon as possible, the Padre Pio pastoral service, and the apostolic visitator, who was a Carmelite, went to Padre Pio, and he has written a very interesting relationship. We can read the Osservatore Romano, in which he said Padre Pio is only a humble Franciscan, a true Capuchin, and a holy man. Which is, I think, is very important, because that is the voice and the report of the Holy See, not of our other kind of offices, mm-hmm. you know.
Did you have the opportunity to read any of the letters that Padre Pio wrote, perhaps during those war years?
Yes, the letters that Padre Pio has written in for his epistolarium, which are now collecting four big volumes. And about these letters, he was always saying, especially to families, men and women who has known during the confessions, to accept what could be happen in their life, thinking that God, said Padre Pio, is doctor and medicine in the same time. That is a wonderful expression that I learned from Padre Pio. So the main purpose which we can find out in his letters, I mean the letters of Padre Pio, is just that he was always saying to the families to accept what could happen, and then that our first strength and energy is the prayer. The prayer, as written Padre Pio, could change the world, could change the events, could change really the history. In one letter, he has written that the history is written not from big or important politician, but from the humble people, from the good families, and especially from our prayer.
Father Gianluigi Pasquale is a Franciscan Capuchin friar and author of the book Secrets of a Soul, Padre Pio's letters to his spiritual directors. The story of Christ's empty tomb spread like wildfire throughout Jerusalem. It was the day Mary Magdalene ran to tell Simon Peter and John that Jesus' body was no longer there. 3 days had passed since his crucifixion on Mount Calvary, and some of his disciples had dispersed out of fear they might be next to face the executioner. In his Gospel, St. Luke recounts the tale of two disciples on the road to Emmaus, a village not far from Jerusalem. On their way, they meet a stranger who turns out to be Jesus himself. While no one knows for sure where the biblical Emmaus is in present-day Israel or the West Bank, scholars have indicated at least three or even more villages that may fit the description of the town and its location between 7 and 20 miles from Jerusalem. Nonetheless, the gospel story is central to Christian belief in the resurrection and the Eucharistic sacrifice. In the Catholic Church, Emmaus has been named a titular see. Well, to understand the story more fully, scholar and author Father Peter Stravinskas takes us on that dusty road to Emmaus for Jesus' encounter with his disciples.
As you recall, on Easter night, our Lord encounters two disciples, hightailing it out of Jerusalem. Clearly, they think the show is over, and what happened to the master, they don't want to happen to them, so they're getting out of the line of fire. And they're encountered on the road by a stranger. I should note that this is one of my favorite passages in the New Testament. In fact, I wrote my master's thesis in theology on this passage. But this stranger encounters them, and as happens frequently in these post-resurrection appearances, it turns out to be the risen Lord, and for some reason, they're not able to perceive him clearly for who he is. Obviously, he has a changed appearance, a transformed, a transfigured, glorified body. There's continuity between his previous earthly existence and now his risen life, but there are also points of discontinuity. The points of continuity, of course, it's a real body, because for apologetical reasons, the evangelists tell us he ate and he drank and he spoke and he walked and so forth. So it's a real body. And interestingly enough, even in that risen body, he bears the wounds of his crucifixion. And we can come back to that in another moment. That's not directly related to the Emmaus story. At the same time, there's discontinuity. He's able to pop in and out of places at will. And for one reason or another, he's not clearly identifiable by facial features. Mary Magdalene, we remember, recognizes him by his voice. In this episode, St. Luke says the disciples were kept from recognizing him. And they start to chat. And he said, "You look downcast. What's the problem?" "Well, you know, are you the only man in Jerusalem who hasn't heard what's gone on there these past couple of days?" "What things?" And they tell him what has happened, and then he proceeds to explain all of the Old Testament scriptures to them that refer to the passion and death of the Messiah. And they're intrigued by this, and they're approaching an inn, at which point they invite him to come in with them. Why? Because they want the conversation to keep going. Somehow or other, what he has said has sparked hope in them. Or rekindled hope, perhaps, is better. And then he sits down at a table with them, and we're told by Luke that he took the bread, blessed it, and broke it. Now, we hearing those words today immediately think we're at Mass. The early Christians, of course, were also using the exact same formula. And it says, in that instant, they recognized him. And then Luke says something very, very strange, and he disappeared from their sight. Well, what's gone on here? Well, as a matter of fact, what we've had is a reenactment of the Mass. The first half, the Liturgy of the Word, this stranger, who turns out to be the Lord, has opened up for them his sacred word, and he's explained it to them. Well, that's what happens in the first half of every Mass. In the second part, they sit down, and he breaks bread, blesses it, gives it to them. In that moment, they recognize him and he vanishes. Why? Because having the Eucharistic Christ, one does not need the historical Christ. It's fulfilled in the sacramental moment. And then they go back and they give this information to the disciples. And it's a very touching and a somewhat amusing situation at the same time. They say they're getting ready to say that the Lord has been raised, and they're greeted with, "The Lord has been raised. It's true. He has appeared to Simon." The evidence for the resurrection is not the appearance to the two disciples. It's not the appearance to Mary Magdalene. It's the appearance to Simon Peter, the Prince of the Apostles. Those apparitions of the risen Lord to Mary Magdalene, to the two disciples, or any others, are all good and wonderful, but they have to be validated by the Prince of the Apostles. And the appearance of Jesus to Simon gives validity to all those other experiences of the risen Christ. In some sense, this Emmaus story is a mini catechism. It gives us all of the essential information we need in one chapter of Luke's Gospel, chapter 24. And it's done through the medium, really, of a play. The actors are very, very real. They're palpable. And the message is incredibly inspiring. And it's a reminder to us that we who live 2,000 years after the death and resurrection of Jesus are no worse off than the apostles who walked and talked with him 2,000 years earlier. Because our access to the risen Christ is every bit as possible and real through the Holy Eucharist as was their experience of him as he walked the roads of Galilee.
But why would Jesus, why didn't he want them to recognize him from the beginning?
I suspect it's because he wants them to recognize him in the way that all Christians thereafter will have to recognize him, in the Eucharist. You know, he says to Mary Magdalene, "Don't touch me," because she's still focused on a very natural relationship with him.
She recognizes his voice.
Right. And then she reaches out to touch him. And he says, "Don't do that." Now, what we do find is, with St. Thomas a week later, he tells him to touch him. Of course, there's also the difference. Thomas is one of the 12. His access to Christ can be very, very different, and would be the difference today between a layperson and a priest. There's a qualitative difference in the relationship, and we have to understand that that's part of the Lord's will for the church, the hierarchical structure of the church. But with Mary Magdalene, she perceives him as the risen Christ, but it's important that she try to put aside those natural connotations that she's had, which are not bad, but they're superseded. It's no different from what our Lord says when that woman in the crowd praises Our Lady and says, "Blessed is the womb that bore you and the breast that fed you." And he said, "Rather, those who hear the word of God and put it into practice." Nothing wrong with his relationship, his natural relationship with his mother, but that would be fulfilled in a much, much deeper relationship, which was not based on blood, but based on discipleship.
Father Peter Stravinskis is founder of the Priestly Society of the Venerable Cardinal John Henry Newman and editor of The Catholic Response. Perhaps two of the most famous pieces of art depicting the gospel story of Emmaus were painted here in Rome by one of the Baroque era's most renowned artists. Though they're not found here in Rome any longer, Caravaggio's two paintings of Emmaus are among the must-knows found in any art history student's textbook. Art historian Elizabeth Leff flips through the pages for us.
The Supper at Emmaus was painted by Caravaggio twice. It was so popular, it was so well received that he, at 5 years distance, was asked to paint a second one. And there, one is in London, and the other one ended up someplace else in Italy, I believe. And so we don't have them here in Rome, although the meditation that produced it was distinctly Roman. It's a subject matter, the Supper at Emmaus, that takes a certain amount of, it comes into its own, let's say, in the 17th century, right at the cusp of the Baroque era, and fits very well with the programs and the ideas of the artists who painted it, who beyond Caravaggio were also Rembrandt van Rijn and Diego Velázquez.
What is so special about these particular paintings by Caravaggio? You were mentioning it's a moment of shock, of surprise, that here these young men are having, you know, a meal with this other man, and then all of a sudden, with the breaking of the bread and sharing of the wine, all of a sudden they realize, wow, this is the Lord, the risen Lord.
Well, the story of this is going back to the beginning of the Supper of Emmaus. Jesus runs into two apostles are walking down the road, and they're talking about the things that have happened. They've talked about, you know, the death of Christ, you know, how hard that was on them, talking about how the women came back, and we're talking about how Jesus wasn't in the tomb. And isn't this all so surprising? And what a time of turmoil. And with them comes another man, and they start to speak to him about things, and Jesus reprimands them. They don't recognize him as Jesus, but he reprimands them for not believing in their prophets. They're foolish. They don't listen. They don't believe. And they still don't get it, and they still keep along the path. Now, the moment that artists like to show is the tail end of this story, after the disciples find that they really like talking to this guy and that he's, you know, really brings them around, says, "Listen, it's getting to be nightfall. Why don't you come and we'll all have dinner together?" You can imagine doing this with any one of your friends, with any person you might meet on the street. You're getting along. Let's go sit down and have a meal. And during the course of the meal, when the guest takes the bread, he breaks the bread and he blesses the food, and then the scales fall from their eyes and they realize says, all this time they have been in the company of the divine. And the thing is that Caravaggio really figured out how to represent that shock in the midst of, you know, what almost seems to be the mundane. And his first version of this work, which was done around 1600, and the first version has a lot of show-offy stuff. I mean, he's a young artist, he's starting out, he wants people to know that he's really good at what he does, and a lot of people are very captivated when they see this painting in London, which has this this very vividly painted basket on the table with fruit on it. The basket looks like it's teetering off the table. This chicken with its two little legs sticking up off to the side. I mean, a very accurately, almost photographic representation of the table. But around the table, you see this incredible gesture. One man's hand stretches straight out towards the viewer. The other man's elbow is pushed back very tightly, and you know that he's leaping backwards. And the light that Caravaggio has just begun to master in 1600 comes in and illuminates the painting. It illuminates the side of Christ's face, which is bent downwards as he blesses. And this creates a sort of dramatic entry of the light, of the dawning of comprehension in this painting. This is really a painting that suits Caravaggio's greatest gift to art in his period, which is the way that Caravaggio could really take the ordinary and make it extraordinary and make us understand that a scene like the Supper at Emmaus, it's meant to make us realize that the divine is in our lives, the supernatural is there, but we don't see it because we get kind of stuck on the mundane. But Caravaggio is able to infuse with that light, with that sense of being startled, the shock of recognizing Jesus in your life.
It almost seems that we are part of that dinner party.
It's another aspect of the painting, which again is a technical, like the foreshortening, is that if you ever stand in front of it, you'll figure out that the three figures are the fourth figure. There's the innkeeper who's sort of standing in the corner saying, what's going on here? But the figures that are standing around or sitting around the table are all our own size. And then the front of the table with the basket teetering towards us, kind of inviting us to come up and push the basket back into our place. So it's all our size, and so we're part of this. It's very much intended to draw the viewer into this recognition of Jesus is in your life. The artists of this time who were working in another vein, they created paintings that were more formally acceptable. They didn't make the men sitting around the table look like normal men. The way that Caravaggio makes Jesus look sort of like a young, unshaven, long-haired, sort of almost you can imagine him as a Roman boy. The two men standing on either side look like the kind of people you'd see working in the streets of Rome. These other artists, they tend to give it a little bit more of an elegant feel. A lot of the times people like to think of holy stories as happening a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away and not really pertinent to our day's life. But Caravaggio takes those stories and he puts them in the here and now for viewers.
Christian art and architecture historian Elizabeth Lev. She teaches at Duquesne University's Rome campus. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.